From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Pope Francis has named 13 new members of the College of Cardinals, continuing to reshape the ranks of the Church's highest leadership. Who are the new princes of the Church? This week on Register Radio, we discuss the new cardinals and all of the latest Vatican news with Register Rome correspondent Edward Penton. And then, social media is now a major part of all of our lives, but what are the risks to our culture and even our religious liberty? We look at the threats from social media with Register contributor Jonathan Liedl. I'm Matthew Bunsen, filling in for Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, who's off this week. Well, this last week, Pope Francis appointed 13 new cardinals from all over the globe. 9 of the new cardinals are eligible to take part in a papal conclave, and Francis has now named a majority of the cardinal electors in a future conclave, reshaping the college for years to come. This week, too, the Vatican pushed ahead with the renewal of its deal with Communist China. What happens next for Chinese Catholics? I'm joined by Register correspondent Edward Penton. Well, Edward, welcome back to Register Radio. It's always great to talk with you.
Great to be back with you, Matthew.
Well, I know you have a book out called The Next Pope, and when I saw the list of the 13 new cardinals from Pope Francis, I immediately thought to myself, well, I wonder if Edward's going to have to update his book. So I guess the starting question for you today is, are you going to have to update your book?
Well, not immediately, but possibly in the future to include some of these new names, because some of them may be probably in the future, but I think having just been appointed, probably not. But that we'll see. We'll see. Yes.
So here we have another set of cardinals from Pope Francis. He has set aside the traditional limit of 120 electors. So now I know that John Paul II did that, I think, twice, including a whopping. At one point, wasn't the cardinal electors reaching about 135? I think in 2001.
Right.
But what are we to make of the fact that he has chosen to go above the limit, even though a number of cardinals will not be aging out, so to speak, to turning 80 for a while?
Yes, it's a good question. I mean, we can only speculate, but I think it's possibly because the Pope feels that the time is running short, that he wants to obviously choose as many as he can in order to further his own vision for the Church. Not that that's a guaranteed outcome, of course, but that's probably part of the reasoning. But also, yes, it is strange in the sense that it's a very tricky time to be having a consistory, of course, at the end of the month, end of November, because of COVID and the chances that you may not be able to allow all the cardinals may not be able to get here for that. So yes, it's an interesting time to have it, and it wasn't expected.
Now, that also raises the question of, so the cardinals do not have to go to Rome in order to effectively become cardinals. This is something that can be done via distance or
right.
simply by the decree of the Holy Father. Is that right?
Right, that is right, because it's not a sacrament as such, but it is. It can be done remotely, but it's these times, though, as I mentioned in the book, they're very rare that you get cardinals coming together, and it means that they don't really get to know each other very well. So it's often a good opportunity for them to come to Rome and get to know each other, and these are good opportunities for that. So I think some will see it as a bit of a pity if that doesn't happen, but we don't know yet. It may all be fine for them to come here.
So how often, in fact, are they in Rome, and how well do they at this point even know each other?
Well, it depends. I mean, some come here quite a lot because they're members of different dicasteries mm-hmm. and so forth. But to get them all here at a consistory is fairly rare. I mean, they used to meet and have actual consistory meetings or a meeting before the ceremony at a cardinal making consistory, but that was done away with in 2015. There hasn't been one since 2015. Pope Francis has not had these, so those don't happen anyway. But at the same time, when there are so many cardinals in Rome for a consistory, that does give them a chance to get to know each other, even if that meeting doesn't take place.
So Pope Francis has appointed 13 new cardinals with this upcoming consistory on November 28th. This is the seventh of his pontificate. Nine of the new cardinal designates are under the age of 80. The other four are sort of octogenarians, so they're outside of the actual voting. They're non-electors. Step back for a second, and what does this group look like sort of collectively within sort of the pattern that we've seen of Francis and this pontificate in appointing cardinals?
Yes, but it's very much in keeping with his choice of cardinals in the past, because he's often chosen those who are not in traditional cardinalatial sees. So again, the big dioceses, metropolitan dioceses, for example, of Milan, Los Angeles, Paris, those have been overlooked, and instead he's gone for those on the periphery, if you like, in the global south. He's chosen a bishop in Rwanda, he's chosen a bishop in Chile, and one in the Philippines. And there are still three Italians under the age of 80, so cardinal electors under the age of 80. But there is a good mix of cardinals from all across the world, from all the continents. And so, again, he's trying to sort of spread it out because, of course, the church is not growing so fast in Europe and the West, but it is growing faster in Asia and parts of Africa. So he's focused on that again in his choices here.
Now, he has a wide number of options for appointments to the college. Is it safe to say that these choices are very personal to him, that he chooses people that he either knows or that he seems to trust or that he's trying to send a message?
Yes, I think that's true. It's interesting that he's chosen again, as with the last conclave, he chose Father Czerny, who's a priest at the time, to be elevated to the College of Cardinals, because he was very important to migration and worked very closely with the Pope on migration issues. So he became from a Jesuit father to, of course, being a Jesuit, it's a strong connection too, but he went straight from being a Jesuit priest to being a cardinal. And again, we've got the Franciscans are very much in focus with this choice, and he's chosen, I think, three Capuchins among the 13 to be elevated to the college, and one who is particularly young. I think he's only in his early 50s, and so he's only a priest in Assisi, and he's elevated him to the college. So yes, I think he clearly knows him. I think he's obviously found a great perhaps leadership qualities in this priest, and believes that he has the what it takes to be a cardinal, and so he's elevated to the college too. So yeah, it does seem as though he's gone very much with not only his usual priorities, but also because he's gone with those he knows best.
So you're talking about Father Mauro Gambetti, right, the guardian of the Sacred Convent of Assisi.
That's right.
Now,
yes.
his appointment, though, is especially interesting because he's himself a man under authority within the Capuchins. So
right.
I guess it raises some intriguing questions, as we have seen before. I know that Pope Francis appointed an auxiliary bishop from El Salvador, who is a longtime friend, a protege of Oscar Romero. But that, as an auxiliary bishop, as a cardinal, it creates all sorts of interesting protocol problems, doesn't it?
Yes, because, of course, the bishop of that diocese, it does cause certain difficulties. Not that they can't be overcome, but that,
right.
He's done that before. Yes, it's an interesting sort of choice, or rather mode of working, that he does this, the mode of appointing, because that isn't usually the traditional way of doing it. So, mm-hmm. So yeah, he's gone down that route again, which he's done in the past before.
Americans are very interested in the appointment, of course, of Archbishop Wilton Gregory, who's 72. He is the Archbishop of Washington. He's been in Washington since May 2019. His name, I know, had surfaced a number of times during his period as the Archbishop of Atlanta for 14 years. What do you make of his appointment? And let's just say that some have also raised the question about other archbishops in the United States who did not receive appointment.
Yes. Well, again, I mean, I think he is sensitive to the whole issue regarding race. And I think he wanted to create the first African-American cardinal in the United States. I think that's part of his choice here. But I think he knows him pretty well, and I think he also is very much in line, I suppose you could say, ideologically, in the sense that he's certainly, I think, on the political side, is very much in tune with Francis. And so that's another reason why he's chosen him. And it's interesting that those who were tipped to become cardinals, perhaps the Archbishop Chaput, who is no longer in Philadelphia, or perhaps Archbishop Gomez in Los Angeles, aren't quite perhaps on the same page as Francis. And so he chose to overlook them, even though those were traditional cardinalatial sees. So yes, I think that's part of it. But of course, Washington is in any way a very important archdiocese. And so in a way, it's to be expected. He has chosen, except for places like Paris, for example, he has chosen usually to have the capital cities of these big metropolises, chosen, and I think that's what he's done here too. So it would be rather odd, I think, for the United States of all countries not to have the Archbishop of the capital city, not a cardinal.
Right. Within the Roman Curia, two notable appointments. One is Bishop Mario Gresh, who is from Malta, who is now the Secretary General of the Synod of Bishops, his successor to Cardinal Lorenzo Baldessari, who just turned 80. But the other is Bishop Marcello Semeraro, who is the new prefect for the Congregation for the Causes of Saints, having been named as a replacement to the now disgraced Cardinal Angelo Becciu. How are we to interpret these two appointments?
Yes, well, again, Bishop Grech, being Secretary General of the Synod of Bishops, is, or at least has been in the last 50, 60 years, a cardinal's position. They often have been cardinals. So I think that's kind of expected. He was chosen, he became Secretary General this year. And so it was natural for him to become cardinal. Bishop Semeraro, who was appointed only recently to become prefect of the Congregation of the Causes of Saints, that's not necessarily, doesn't have to be a cardinal. In fact, the Pope has tried to sort of veer away from making people, those who are heads of curial dicasteries, cardinals automatically, which has been the tradition of the past. But he has nevertheless made Bishop Semeraro cardinal. And I think it's also in recognition for his work on the as secretary to the Council of Cardinals, which has been advising the Pope on curial and church reform. And I think it's perhaps a certain to show a certain appreciation for that work, which he's done for the past 7 years. So I think that all comes into play.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking farther afield, you mentioned Rwanda, Archbishop Antoine Kambanda of Kigali. He, I think, has a rather remarkable family history, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. He is the Archbishop of Kigali. Yeah, he lost his parents and five of his six siblings during the terrible genocide there in 1994. One of his brothers actually lives here in Italy, apparently. And he is relatively young. He's 62. He's apparently worked very hard for reconciliation in his homeland, something that the Pope obviously recognizes and values very much. And so he was chosen. And of course, again, as I said earlier, it's again focusing on where the faith is growing fastest, which is parts of Africa and certainly places like Rwanda. So these have all been important, I think, in that choice.
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned as well Chile, the Bishop, the Archbishop of Santiago de Chile, Archbishop Celestino Ausbraso. This is somebody who inherited, I think it's safe to say, a disaster in the Chilean church. But he's mm-hmm. also raised a few eyebrows himself, hasn't he, with some of his decisions regarding the distribution of communion.
Yes, he was caught on video, I think, earlier this year or last year, distributing communion, refusing to distribute communion to two communicants who were kneeling. I think he apologized for that afterwards. But yes, that was what he made headlines for. But I think he's interesting in that he's also 75. He's already getting on a bit in years. And that's, of course, the retirement age normally of a of a bishop. And also, he's only been a bishop actually since 2014. So it's quite an interesting case. He's actually Spanish born and moved to Chile, I think, in the 1980s, where he was sent there as a missionary. So, but he's been quite significant in trying to help the church in Chile recover from the sexual abuse scandals.
So as you noted, we also have a new cardinal from the Apostolic Vicariate of Brunei, Bishop Cornelius Sim, who, for our audience, would be of interest. He's, I know, a graduate of Franciscan University Steubenville, as well as the Archbishop of Siena. But I wanted to finish up here with two names, Raniero Cantalamessa and Archbishop Silvano Tomasi.
Yes. I mean, Father Cantalamessa, again, he's come from being just a priest to, well, not just a priest, but from being a priest to straight to a cardinal. Of course, when they're appointed, those who are over 80, they're often chosen by the Pope because of their distinguished service to the Church. And Father Cantalamessa has been the papal preacher for, I think, going back to 1980. So he's done a long stint there of service as the papal preacher. He's become very popular. He's very well known. And so the Pope has chosen to elevate him. And then there's Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, who's a long-serving papal diplomat. He's served in various places, most notably as the Holy See representative to the United Nations in Geneva, which he did for many years, I think over well over a decade, I think maybe 14 years or so. So he's been recognized for that service, and he also was involved with the Knights of Malta. There's certain he sort of came into certain questions regarding the financing of the Order of Malta and the fact that he was appointed one of the five member commission that Cardinal Parolin set up to investigate the dismissal of the Grand Chancellor of the Knights of Malta.
Right.
So he's very close to the order there, but I think this is primarily in recognition for his diplomatic service, and I think he was very instrumental in helping bring peace between Eritrea and Ethiopia in the, I think it was in the 1990s when he was apostolic nuncio there, and he's very much a modest man, not someone who would trumpet that, but he did play quite a significant role in bringing the two sides together.
Well, shifting gears before I let you go, the Vatican has renewed its deal with Communist China. What happens next for Chinese Catholics?
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, it's obviously there's quite a lot of division about this, and it's certainly the we've already seen since it was signed continued repression and violent repression of faith groups and particularly the church in China. So it's had no real effect, even though they've renewed it. Now the Vatican wasn't necessarily expecting that. The continual message is that this is a long process, that patience is needed, and that this is going to take a long time for the fruits to be seen. But at the same time, when I think we're going to see continual aggression really from the Chinese Communist Party against the church, and I don't see that changing right now. I think that we're going to see that continue. So I think that's pretty much going to carry on as before, possibly with even more repression, but yes, that seems to be the effect of this. But it was expected. I mean, I think most people expected the Vatican to renew this, because it was difficult really to go back on it now.
That's right.
And they're very much committed to pursuing this line of engagement with the Chinese authorities.
All right. Well, Edward Penton, I know you'll be covering all of it. Great to talk with you, as always.
Great. Good to be with you, Matthew. Thank you.
Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'm joined by Register contributor Jonathan Liedl to discuss the impact and the risks of social media. This is Register Radio.
In In these uncertain times, Catholics depend on EWTN's National Catholic Register. The Register is so much more than a newspaper. It's your faith, your life, your source of information and spiritual resources. The Register is uplifting, redemptive journalism, interviews with Catholic leaders and newsmakers, liturgical coverage, health, financial, and political topics, and analysis of the key issues you care most about. EWTN's National Catholic Register covers every aspect of the Catholic faith that impacts your world. To get 6 free issues, order online at ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. That's ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, filling in for Jeanette DeMello, the editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register this week, who's out. Well, there has been quite a bit of scrutiny over Facebook and Twitter and other social media platforms over blocked content that seems very clearly to curb free speech. It's a question, in fact, of whether or not there is a pattern of censorship, in particular against conservatives and especially religious conservatives. There have been calls for government regulation and real concerns about censorship and what all of this could mean, the implications for religious liberty. To discuss all of this, I'm joined by Register contributor Jonathan Liddle, who has a piece just out on Big Tech's Big Bias, Religious Conservatives Face Scary Pattern of Censorship. Jonathan, welcome.
Good to be with you, Matthew.
So I know that the Senate Commerce Committee held a hearing on October 28th to discuss Section 230 and censorship concerns with a number of CEOs, including those of Google, Facebook, and Twitter. First, what happened at this hearing? And for those who may not be that familiar with it, what exactly is Section 230?
Yeah, Section 230 is a seemingly obscure part of the Communications Decency Act. Now, this was passed in 1996 in a bipartisan way by Congress. And essentially what Section 230 does is it establishes that there's such things called public forums on the Internet, places where people will come and they'll share content. We think today the manifestations of that are clearly Facebook, where you post articles, or your own comments, or YouTube, where users upload videos. And what Section 230 did is it established that these public forums, they're not liable in the same way that a publisher would. So if the Register, for instance, or EWTN were to publish content that violated copyright law or someone potentially used in a malicious way, the Register or EWTN would be liable, right? They could be sued over that. So Section 230 essentially gave a buffer for these types of public forums to not be held accountable in that way, which everyone agreed at the time was important if the Internet was going to be some place that was open and free, encouraged lively discussion and lots of viewpoints. The problem, though, if we fast forward, over a decade into the 2010s, is that people have been increasingly concerned that these platforms, these big tech platforms that we talk about, they've been increasingly operating not just as public forums, but actually as publishers with a clear kind of editorial bias. So Section 230 always allowed for these forums to moderate like really clearly harmful content, inciting violence, child pornography, things like that could be removed, and that did not constitute essentially being a publisher. But what we're seeing now, most recently probably with the New York Post story, which maybe we'll get into, is that these big tech companies are exercising almost a lot of discretion in terms of what content they allow on their websites. Also, even how they shape content, there'll be maybe a trending news story on Twitter, and Twitter will actually organize stories, on their page, and they'll write their own headline. So they're already kind of providing a spin on a topic that's out there. It's not just completely neutral. So this has been, you know, we can get into the history of it too, but it's been a concern for especially conservatives, but also on the other side, liberals of Section 230 and the immunity it allows some of these big tech companies. So this Senate committee hearing just the other day, you know, brought these concerns to bear, and there's real conversation going on right now about potentially revoking Section 230.
Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of stories. There are a lot of claims about censorship, about being deplatformed, demonetized. I know the Babylon Bee, which is a satire site, was briefly mm-hmm. and has run into a number of problems with some of the social media platforms, which seem to be somewhat oblivious or unaware of the fact that it's actually a satire site. I'm thinking in particular of the New York Post story. That seems to have really sparked a great deal of concern. What happened here?
Yeah, so on October 14th, the New York Post ran a story, and the story alleged, on the basis of emails recovered from a laptop that purportedly belonged to Hunter Biden, the son of Joe Biden, it alleged that Joe Biden, as vice president in 2016, had met with some executives from Burisma, a Ukrainian energy company that Hunter Biden was working for at the time. And this is, you know, this would be a potentially, you know, bombshell of a story, right? If true, given the fact that Joe Biden has repeatedly denied that he's ever had any involvement in his son's foreign business ventures. And additionally, you know, it would seem to suggest that Joe Biden, as vice president, was using his political position to essentially influence and promote, you know, financial gain for members of his family. Definitely something problematic and something worth looking into. What's interesting, though, is that the story has, you know, it's become a huge talking point kind of across the media, not even primarily for those contents, but because of how Facebook and Twitter reacted and responded to the story. On the same day that it was published, Facebook took steps to essentially lower the visibility of this article. If I posted this article on my account, Facebook was taking steps so that it would appear lower in people's news feeds. So, you know, you'd have to scroll down and down and down, and then maybe there it would be. Twitter went even further. Twitter actually took the step of completely banning and preventing any tweet from going up that included you know, a hyperlink to this story. Not only a hyperlink, but even a picture. If I took a picture of this New York Post story and tried to tweet it, I was unable to do so. And the New York Post also had its account locked as well. So this really, I think, for a lot of people, because it was such a prominent issue and there was all kinds of discussion about it, it really brought this issue of big tech censorship to the foreground. It showed essentially how powerful these companies can be in terms of shaping the public discourse, in terms of shaping even the marketplace of ideas. And I think it also revealed that not only do they have this power, that there might be a question of bias. There might be a question of a kind of political partisan leaning. You know, as I report in the story, the employees and the executives of these Silicon Valley companies are not at all representative of the American public. We can look at that on, you know, contentious issues like same-sex marriage, civil marriage, and abortion rights. The rates of support among these companies, among the executives, I recall, are 96% for same-sex civil marriage and 79% favorable of abortion rights, which are well above kind of the national average. And then you look at the question of religion, and it's almost more stark there. On religion, these workers, half of them identify as atheists or agnostic, which obviously there's an increase of that in America over the past several decades, but that's still significantly higher than the 7% of the general public who has the same view. So it does seem that there is you know, it's fascinating. I think it's fascinating because we are having conversations right now about systemic bias, you know, in, for instance, in the area of policing. And I think it's a conversation worth having. But if those factors might be in play in something like that, then it also seems super relevant to the people who are controlling our news. What biases do they bring to the table? What are their own kind of pre-commitments, their own ideological convictions, and how might that shape what stories they allow and what stories they censure? And I think, you know, for religious conservatives, the New York Post story, it just kind of brought to national attention what a lot of them have already experienced, whether we're talking about, you know, pro-life advocates who for years have experienced apparently unfair censorship and difficulty in getting advertisements out and even posting factually accurate information and videos. And then you mentioned the Babylon Bee story, which maybe we'll talk about quickly here. The Babylon Bee, of course, is a conservative satire site, which often posts, you know, Christian-themed content as well. They ran a story during the confirmation hearing for now Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Again, a satirical story. You know, the premise was Democrats were amazed at how intelligent and poised Justice Barrett had been, and their conclusion was that she must be a witch. And then there's a clear reference to a scene from a Monty Python movie, the comedic British acting troupe.
Indeed.
Where there's a witch trial, and there's talk about burning witches, and Facebook essentially viewed this as inciting violence. They demonetized the Babylon Bee's Facebook page. They removed the content. I talked to Seth Dillon, who's the CEO of Babylon Bee. He told me that eventually all that was reversed. But what's interesting is that it wasn't reversed initially after he went to Facebook and said, hey, we think you made a mistake here. This is just satire. It's a joke. We're not, this isn't fake news. No one is going to really take this as inciting violence. It's a reference to a movie joke. He said it was only after there was kind of a larger outcry from conservative media that Facebook ultimately reversed its decision, which I think highlights, and he pointed out, you know, Babylon Bee and maybe some of these big pro-life organizations are able to get big tech companies to reconsider the restrictions they place on them. But for a parish or for an individual person, it seems like if you don't have that kind of clout, your viewpoint might be left out of the discussion.
So it sounds as though they might have been better off staying with something along the lines from the same sketch, basically, that she turned me into a newt. Would that perhaps have been safer? But
well,
but it tells us something, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think. Well, I mean, yeah, I think the data. I'd be interested because there's some contention. There are articles going back and forth on the internet about whether there is bias against conservatives or not. You know, I'm interested in continuing to learn more about what kind of, you know, objective empirical studies might show. But, you know, Seth Dillon at the Babylon Bee, he pointed out to me, as far as he knows, The Onion, which is kind of a more mainstream, even left-leaning satirical site, as far as he knows, they've never faced any of these kinds of restrictions. They've never been, you know, claimed to be fake news. And then you look at the abortion issue. And I talked to Mallory Quigley, who's the vice president of communications at the Susan B. Anthony List, a very important pro-life advocacy group. You know, most recently they had advertisements that were set to go out in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, two important battleground states this election, advertisements that talked about Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's you know, views on late-term abortion. And the ads were prevented from running because a third-party fact-checker initially said they include debunked information, that they lied. And, you know, ironically, shortly after that, the third party fact checker said, oh, we made a mistake, and they went back into play. But talking to Mallory Quigley, she said, you know, they hear reports from inside these big tech companies that sometimes groups like Planned Parenthood or NARAL run into these kinds of issues. But we never hear about it in the news. We never hear about in the same way we do pro-life groups having to essentially go to these big tech companies and argue that they should be reinstated, or to get conservative media to draw attention to it. We're not really seeing that kind of dynamic on the other side of the equation. And so it really does, I think, suggest a pattern of bias, a pattern of censorship, which brings us, I think, to questions of free speech.
Right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately, but I know that this is a story that you're going to continue to cover, especially once we get past the election and into a new administration.
Yes, we will. We all have to wait until then, because we're coming down to the wire there. But after that, everything will be fair game. But thanks for having me on, Matthew, and thanks for letting me talk about this.
Well, Register contributor Jonathan Liddle, you can find his article at ncregister.com. Well, that concludes this episode for this week. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks so much for joining me here on EWTN. For Jeanette DeMello and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Until next week, take care and God bless.